So good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It is a delight to be with you today and an honor. I have always tickled when people invite me to come and speak because I'm like, I have something to say that they want to hear. That surprises me sometimes, right? But anyway, as Diane mentioned, I'm a chaplain for the Department of Corrections here in Oregon. I work at the women's prison down in Wilsonville. And many of the people I work with have committed crimes. Some of them have hurt or killed children. Some of them have killed their husbands or neighbors or friends. They've stolen property. They've drove drunk. They have ruined the financial lives of other people. They have broken relationships. They've burned bridges. They've burned down houses. Many are cut off from their families, either because their families are sick of their BS or because their family is so dysfunctional that they have to let go in order to grow and heal. Most people are somewhere in between. And my job as a chaplain, my calling really, is to love them. And that doesn't mean that I coddle them or I excuse them of their wrongdoings. It means that I listen to them. And I learn about who they are and where they've been. I do a lot of listening. I offer bits of encouragement and maybe some comfort when I can. I pray with them and I laugh with them and sometimes I cry with them. I cannot make them heal or grow or change, but I can offer them the space that they need to do that. And my humble gratitude to do it with them. But even if they don't grow or they don't change, I'll still be there. I'll be there when their mom goes in for surgery, or when their brother is killed by a drunk driver, or when they become grandparents for the first time, or when their kids go up for adoption. As you can imagine, this work has given me some interesting experiences in life. A few years ago, I went outside with some of the women to say prayers and smudge near the sweat lodge at our facility because her father died, and she wanted a chance to say goodbye and to cut her hair with some close friends and an auntie. And she brought out a photo of her and her dad, and she balanced it on a piece of wood that we had out there, and it was a photo that was taken in the visiting room at Sheridan Federal Prison. And he was in his prison browns, and she was in her teenage phase of high hairsprayed hair and loud makeup. And she told me that she pretty much grew up in that visiting room. Her father was only out of prison for about 3 years of her life, but they were the best years of her life because they were the only years in which she wasn't abused. They were the only years in which no one took advantage of her and no one dared to hurt her or to degrade her in any way. She says everything she learned from him, which could be part of the reason why she's behind bars today, but I don't know. I also don't know what he did to end up in prison. I'm pretty sure it wasn't buying groceries for somebody who couldn't afford it. But I know his daughter, after all, and she is tough and strong and stubborn and connected. And I stood out there with these women, and we gave thanks for his life, for the blessing that he was to her, for all the love that he had and all the care that he gave to his friends and his family. We honored his memory, his wisdom, and his life. And in the back of my mind, I thought, I wonder what his victims would think of this. I wonder what they would say about the passing of this man. But I wasn't with them. I was there with her, and we mourned, and we gave thanks for his life. People are complicated. This came true for me in my own life. When I was a kid, I was a teenager, and my mom was married to a guy named Joe, and he was a minister, and he was a mean guy at home. He was one of those ministers who was pretty harmful to his own family and to us kids. But he would preach about love and compassion and generosity in the pulpit. And about 5 or 6 years ago when he died, my stepsister and I was sitting next to my stepsister at the funeral, and these people were getting up and they were talking about Joe and what a great guy he was and what a mentor he was and how compassionate he was and how generous he was with his time and how kind he was. And I leaned over to my stepsister and I said, "Who the hell are they talking about?" But he was a good guy for some people. And after enough time has gone by and my own healing has taken place, some days I can recognize that and I can honor that his crossing of paths with some people was a good, positive, encouraging thing. It wasn't for me, but I'm glad he wasn't a jerk to everyone. I'm glad that he was a blessing somewhere. People are complicated. But we live in a culture that likes things to be really black and white, right? We like to divide people and things and experiences and cars into bad and good, right? It's us and it's them. It's good and bad. It's the haves and it's the have-nots. And this is historic. I mean, this is something that has been around in our culture since the time the white folks showed up and wiped out all those other people because they were savages, because they were not white. And then we perpetuated again in slavery when we enslaved people because they weren't really people. They were other. They weren't us. And it continues currently in our state of politics, in our prison system, in our newsreels, in our movies. I love movies, but they're so black and white. It's the good guy and the bad guy, and they're never the two shall meet. Right? This is the narrative of America. This is the narrative of what it means to be a human being. It means it's all or nothing. It means you're with me or you're against me. It means we are on different sides of the divide. And we are descendants of a Christian gospel that ultimately sides with the underbelly, the oppressed, the powerless people. I mean, if we look at who Jesus hung out with, the tax collectors and the prostitutes and the homeless and the lepers and the prisoners and the least of these, we inherited a theology of solidarity with the suffering. But it's interesting that it's other people's suffering. But that's a different sermon, perhaps. And there's this is an important theological place to be, because when we join in solidarity with the oppressed people, it challenges our own sense of prestige or status or cultural values of worth that we have absorbed into our skin, and it widens our own vision of what it means to be a human being in America. That it's not as easy as we've all been told. It's not as easy as we've all been told. And we're able to connect. And in that connection, we experience the holy and the ways in which we are related and interdependent with everyone. And when we work for justice and equality, we choose the have-nots over the haves every time. And then this happens. People in power, people with guns, people with authority, they become the bad guys. They become the scourges of justice. They become the wrongdoers and the misled and the villains. And what have we done? We've just flipped the paradigm. The people in power are now the disdained ones. The people in power are now the underbelly. And we know who's on the side of love. We know who's on the side of love. We have participated wholeheartedly in a worldview divided. In a worldview divided by power and privilege, us versus them. We have chosen sides. Now, I'm not saying that we can't choose sides. I'm not saying that our positions aren't worthy of our time and our energy and our efforts. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that these divisions are imaginary illusions that we just need to get over and jump into this romantic idea of unity in America. Okay? I'm not saying that. But what I am saying, these divides are real. They are ubiquitous. They are historically grounded in the roots of who we are. Racial bias is real. White supremacy is real. The power dynamics that do disservice to the poor and the black and the people of color, that's real. And we cannot deny that. But what I am asking of us is if our compassion and our love is defined by this duality as well. There's another strain of our history found in the book of Matthew. It's the passage where Jesus is talking about, I'll just read it to you. Have it here somewhere. Here we go. This comes after he talks about the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor, for they will inherit the earth, and blessed, and he says this. He says, "You have heard it was said, love your neighbor as yourself, and hate your enemy." We've heard that. We hear it every day. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, because then you may be children of your Father in heaven. God causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. And if you love those who love you, what reward do you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people more than others, don't even the pagans do that? Be perfect in love, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect in love. When I hear that passage, what I hear is, if you only love those that are easy to love, what do you learn? How do you grow? If you really want to learn about love, try loving your enemies. That's the real challenge, because really, what you'll find out is they aren't much different than you. This message really came home to me when I was lucky enough to be at Standing Rock a few years ago. And I was standing at the sacred fire along with a bunch of other people, and one of the elders got up, and they had made a pretty strong statement that weekend about all the veterans had come to town. This was the weekend when all the veterans come to town, and the veterans had a plan, right? They were gonna make stuff happen. They were gonna show those cops what it was all about. And the elders sat down with them and said, "No, we don't want that. We don't want any more violence. We don't want any more hatred. We don't want that. We want peace, and we want you to help us take care of our people." And one of the elders got up, and she said, "Today we offer forgiveness to those who have harmed us in the past. And we have every right to be angry about what has happened, but we need not throw that anger across the river at them, because they too must go home to their children and to their communities. And that is not the way of peace or justice." It reminded me of what Martin Luther King said in a eulogy for those kids who died in the Birmingham church bombings back in the 60s. And he says, "These victims, these children, they say to each of us, black and white, that we must substitute courage for caution. They say to us that we must be concerned not merely about who murdered them, but about the system, the way of life, and the philosophy which produced the murderers. We must be concerned with who murdered them, and for the system that rose up these people who thought this was the right thing to do." He doesn't say we ignore the difference. He doesn't say we romanticize our community. But he says we have to be willing to see beyond the divides, beyond our prejudice, beyond our opinions, beyond our personal inclinations, into the systems of power and socialization that shape so much of who we are allowed to be in this world. This system that we have is bad for all of us. It's bad for all of us. Correctional officers who work in prisons have, out of any other profession, have the highest rates of suicide, divorce, alcohol and drug abuse, domestic violence, early death, PTSD. There are some correctional officers who go to work and they say that we're going into a war zone. There are some prisons where people who work desk jobs wear flak jackets, right? Flak jackets. So if they get stabbed, it won't go through. If they get shot at, it won't. A desk job. Not in Oregon. But there are some states in which the reality of how we do prison, it's bad for everybody. And who's on top of that system? Who perpetuates that system? us white culture people, us white people. Look at our economic system. Look at our political system. Look at our prison criminal justice system. Who's on top? Who's in the middle? And who's at the bottom? It's our job to change these systems because we are a part of them. It's our job to elect DAs that are concerned about more than just their how many people they put in prison. It's our job to elect legislators who are concerned about more than just getting reelected. And it's our job to do this not by pointing fingers, not by using shame or degradation or insults, but with love. Because it's only with love that real transformation can take place. I know that I have never changed my mind because somebody cussed me out. Never. I have never been persuaded to believe something else or to do something different because somebody threw stones at me or shunned me or wouldn't talk to me anymore. The only way that I have ever changed my mind is when I have been with someone who hears me and sees me in the depth of who I am and who I want to be, and speaks with me about what that means in my life. Authentic love stands in a very difficult and uncomfortable place. This is not love light. This is not diet love. This is big love. This is true love. This is a love that embraces the entirety of who we are, as well as who other people are. It's the only kind of love that can really hold us in health and healing and hope. Because otherwise, we're denying that part of us that has broken the vows 1,000 times. This love calls us beyond the fields of right and wrong, beyond the divisions of good and bad, beyond the concepts of enemy and friend. And it changes us. It heals us. And the reality is that that is how we begin to heal the world. May it be so, and amen.